The next case is 08-366, Randy J. Epley versus Tri-Valley Local School District. Mr. Stinn.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Mike Stinn, and I'm here representing the Tri-Valley Local School District Board of Education, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
Thank you. This case presents ultimately two questions. Was the complaint filed by the plaintiff timely filed, and if it was not, who or which defendant does a claim or claim exist against? The plaintiff filed a wrongful death action against the Tri-Valley Local School Board of Education and two John Doe defendants who have never been identified or served with a copy of the complaint or a summons in 2005, shortly after Joshua Epley, or within 2 years of his passing. The plaintiff then voluntarily dismissed the complaint 2 months before the 2 year period set forth in 21-2502D was set to expire. The 2 year period was set to expire November 23rd, 2005. The plaintiff dismissed it approximately 2 months before. And then 10 months after November 23, 2005, and September of 2005, the plaintiff refiled the wrongful death claim. And the 2 year period in 21-2502D is an essential element of the claim. The plaintiff has to prove that it was filed within 2 years. The plaintiff could not do that. We filed a motion, and the trial court granted it. And on appeal, the Court of Appeals held that statute was unconstitutional. It is not unconstitutional. There's a rational basis for it. The legislature had the opportunity to amend it in April of 2005, did not do so. The legislature also had the opportunity in April of 2005 to amend 21-2504, which is the saving statute for wrongful death claims, and it did not do so, even though it had earlier, approximately a year or so, amended 2305.19.
If we decide this case on the savings clause,
yes,
not being applicable, does that end it? Do we need to reach the immunity issue?
If you decide that 21-2504 is unconstitutional, then 2305.19 would apply to this case. You then would have to decide which of the defendants the claim still exists against. So you would have to decide whether the complaint stated a cause of action against the Board of Education.
Okay, maybe I didn't make myself
clear. Or the John
clear.
Doe defendants.
If we find that that they filed out of time, is the case over?
The case would be over, Your Honor, because
so
the 2 years.
So if we find it unconstitutional that we get to the next issue.
That's correct. Okay. I don't believe that you should find it unconstitutional because I don't believe that it is.
But
it would end the case against all of the defendants. Yes, Your Honor.
Should we not reverse the order? Usually if we decide a case based upon the law rather than the constitutional issue, that resolves the case.
That's correct, and you can do that in this case. You don't have to reach
first.
Pardon me?
That would mean we would discuss the immunity question first, right?
If you want to discuss the immunity question first, then
in terms of disposing
in disposing of the case, the claim that was filed against the board essentially is that Joshua Epley was allowed to go home with a fellow student after school, and unfortunately the student who was driving the car negligently drove the car, caused it to flip over off of the roadway, and Joshua was thrown from the car and unfortunately passed away because of the accident.
And there's no question that the car was not owned by the school district and the accident occurred off the property of the school.
That's correct. The accident occurred on, I think it was Route 80, well, it wasn't Route 83, but it was a state road several miles from the school. Corey Jenkins was the driver of the automobile. He was a student in the school district. He was not an employee of the school district. There is no exception that I'm aware of that applies to this case, nor is there any set of facts that I can conceive of that would make an exception to the immunity afforded to the board apply to this case. There are five exceptions in 2744.02B, and I don't believe any of those apply to this case. The first exception is negligent operation of a motor vehicle, which certainly applies to Mr. Jenkins, but since he was not an employee of the school board, it does not apply to the board. The second is a proprietary function. The provision of a system of public education is a governmental function, and it's defined as such as in 2744.01C2C, I believe. And because it is a governmental function, it's not a proprietary function. The third exception is the maintenance of a nuisance on a public road. Well, the school board doesn't maintain the road. It can't be found to have acted negligently in doing so. The fourth is if the injury occurred on school grounds due to the negligence of a school employee and due to a defect on the property. Well, again, there was no defect. It didn't happen on school grounds, and the negligence wasn't part of the school employees. It was negligence of a fellow student, someone unrelated completely to the board. And finally, the fifth exception is found in 2744.02B5, and that, on the date of the incident, said that there has to be a specific section of the revised code that specifically says the school board is liable, and there is none of which I'm aware that specifically makes the board liable for the death that occurred under the facts of this case as I know them and what was pled.
There's a list of, in the Court of Appeals opinion, the various defenses that were raised. Was proximate cause a defense that was raised or not?
We did not file an answer to the complaint. What we filed was a motion on for judgment on the pleadings. So we actually haven't even gotten to the end of the pleading stage. But there's no set of facts, and as I understand it, there has to be something pled in the complaint or that conceivably exists that makes the plaintiff have a claim, sets forth the state of a claim.
Well,
and there isn't
is it
in this
8C
case.
Or what?
For me?
Part of the rule requires you to set forth affirmative defenses in the pleadings, doesn't it?
Yeah, when you file an answer, certainly you have to assert all affirmative defenses.
And you never file an answer?
No, we filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings under Rule 12C, which says that based on the pleadings, there is no claim that has been made against the school board or the John Doe defendants. One of the reasons was it wasn't timely filed. They couldn't meet the two-year statute. The other reason with respect to the board and the John Doe defendants is that they are immune from liability. The board, under the Cater test, the three-tier analysis, 2744.02A1, no exception under 2744.02B1-5, and even if there's an exception, there is a defense under 2744.A3 or A5 to the claim with respect to the board. With respect to the John Doe defendants, 2744.03A6 applies to the John Doe defendants, and they are immune unless they acted manifestly outside the scope of their employment with a malicious purpose, wantonly or recklessly, or there's a specific statute of the revised code that imposes liability on them.
Okay. But wasn't there a claim of some negligence on the part of the school officials in permitting the student to leave with this driver?
That's the only claim that I'm aware of that was in the merit brief filed by the plaintiffs. They claimed in that for the first time before this court that there was some history of the board allowing students to
that wasn't pled
off.
In the complaint.
That was not pled in the complaint. What was pled in the complaint was one reckless conduct. And what the Court of Appeals did on this issue was apply the wanton reckless conduct to the board. They said in their opinion that the board could be conceivably liable because the complaint states a set of facts that their employees were wanton and reckless under 2744.03A6. And that's not the right test. You don't get to wanton or reckless with respect to the board unless there's an exception to immunity and the court is dealing with a defense. And there are really two defenses that could be applicable to the board if there's an exception. One is 2744.03A3, which doesn't contain any mention of wanton or reckless conduct, or 2744.03A5. And that's the only statute in the defense section, 2744.03, that states willful or wanton or reckless conduct. But you don't even get there. That's a shield, not a sword. It's a defense and immunity.
I understand.
And you don't get there unless an exception exists.
I understand.
That's the problem I'm having, Counsel. And this statute is a winding road, to say the least, in terms of what's in and what's out. And I'm having trouble getting my mind wrapped around the notion that you're trying to take this out on failure to state a claim without getting to the point of examining the defenses because of the way the statute's structured. I mean, I understand the motion to kick something out on failure to state a claim. But under this statute, you start out, and then you have the what-ifs, and you're back and forth. And
Well, I think it's the plaintiff's burden to prove a set of facts in the complaint that...
No, you don't prove a set of facts
in the
complaint.
I'm sorry. To state a set of facts that, if proved, could state a claim against a defendant. The complaint does not state those facts which the plaintiff has to show to get around immunity. The defendant, the board, is a political subdivision. It's immune under 2744.02A1 unless one of the exceptions applies. One of those exceptions, which the plaintiff argues in its merit brief, is 2744.02B4. Again, that was not argued before the trial court or the Court of Appeals, but 2744.02B4 says that the injury or death has to occur on school grounds because of the negligence of a school employee due to a defect on those school grounds. Those are three facts, elements, that they have to show to make the exception. The complaint doesn't state that. In fact, it can't state it. There are no set of facts that would make that because the accident was a motor.
Your view of the statute is that if the school took the kids on a trip over to Mohegan on a float trip and the teachers said jump in the canoe and forget to put on the life vest, that there's immunity because you're not on the school grounds.
On that, with respect to that, there is a case, and it was, I can't remember the case, but there's a case where a plaintiff fell through a hole in her house that was under construction by a school industrial arts class. It was a school project. And in that case, the court found that that didn't meet one of the exceptions because it was governmental activity, a governmental function, and it didn't happen on school grounds. That's correct.
Okay. I guess I'm just testing the notion. It strikes me that you may be premature. You may have great arguments and prevailing arguments, but that you're early in the process to just go out on the pleadings.
I don't think under what was pled in the complaint that there's any set of facts that would be applicable to the board.
If
you find the statute 212504 unconstitutional and that the complaint was saved by 2305.
Well, the Chief's pointed out you've got it backwards.
Well, I understand that, but then it would go back, I think, against the John Doe defendants because the complaint says that the employees acted willfully, wantonly, or recklessly. And 2744.03A6, which applies only to the employees, that conceivably sets forth a claim that could be made by the plaintiff if they prove wanton or reckless conduct against the employees. But against the board, it doesn't go back.
Mr. Stinn,
yes, ma'am.
Did they allege the section 2 under 2744.02B2, the negligent proprietary function against the board?
They did not allege in the complaint 2744.02B2, which is a proprietary function.
And that really, if we're talking, as Justice Pfeiffer was considering the the hypothetical situation of the board's, the school's activity, let's say, that would be the exception that would be most likely, would it not? A B2 exception rather than the one that was alleged, which was B4?
No, I disagree, Your Honor, because under Judge Pfeiffer's hypothetical, that would be a school activity. That would be the provision of a system of public education. And the statute, 2744.01.2c2, specifically defines governmental function as a system of provision of a system of public education. So that school function is provision of a governmental function, and the B2 exception doesn't apply. They're mutually exclusive.
Did they talk? They didn't cite the one you just mentioned either.
No, they didn't cite. There's no section, no exception section. None of the B5, 1 through 5 sections were cited in the complaint. The complaint merely states that the school board or its employees were willful, wanton, reckless, and negligent.
So they're really missing a step, is what you're saying in the complaint.
Well, I think they missed a step in the complaint, but I don't think that they could have under the facts
but
as
you don't,
applied in the complaint.
You don't ever have to plead the statute. You have to plead a set of operative facts that gives rise to a cause of action.
That's correct, Your Honor. You do. You don't have to plead the statute.
Yeah.
You don't have to prove or plead the exceptions, but right. You do, I think, have to plead sufficient facts to get around the immunity. And the plaintiff certainly should have known that we were going to allege immunity because they filed the complaint once before, and we filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings in which we alleged immunity in that. And we've alleged immunity throughout this case. They should have known that we were going to do that. And had they tailored their second complaint differently, we might not be here, but they didn't. And there isn't really any set of facts that I can conceive of that would get around the immunity.
As I read the Court of Appeals opinion, it finds that both the board and the individual defendants are still subject to further action.
That's correct. The Court of Appeals found that the 20
individuals could still be, obviously, there could be a finding against them. The individuals who permitted the allegations that some school person permitted the driver of the car to take the other student with him in an unauthorized manner. So that's still an issue as to personal liability, right?
Well, it would be if it went back to the trial court.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what I'm saying. I read the Court of Appeals opinion to say exactly that, that it's remanded to the trial court, both the board, you're representing the board, because you don't want to be liable, obviously, but the individual defendants could still be.
Yeah, the Court of Appeals in the opinion said that it goes back against the board and the individual defendants, but in the paragraph that you're referring to, the Court of Appeals did that because it believed that 2744.03A6
right.
applied to the board.
Right.
And what I'm saying in my brief and what I'm saying here before you is that if you find 2125.04 unconstitutional, which I believe it is not, then it would go back, but it goes back only against the John Doe defendants because under the complaint, the facts that were pled in the complaint, they have a claim arguably against the John Doe defendants, not against the board.
I think we understand your argument. Thank you, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you.
Mr. Traska.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Peter Traska, and along with my co-counsel, John Gold, we represent the estate of Joshua Epley by and through his father, Randy Epley, the appellees herein. I'm going to quote from this court's opinion in Morris versus Savoy in 1991. It is irrational and arbitrary to impose the cost of the intended benefit to the general public solely upon a class consisting of those most severely injured. Now, that case was specific to medical malpractice damage claims, but that language, as far as the constitutionality issue is concerned, is directly on point to the equal protection issue presented by this case. There is no rational basis why wrongful death claimants should not enjoy the savings protection similar to that given to every other civil litigant by Revised Code 2305.19. I have three main reasons why appellees would ask you to affirm the decision of the Fifth District Court of Appeals. The first is simply the plain language of the revised saving statute, the generally applicable saving statute. The word any means any. It means all causes of action, and it supersedes any substantive amendment to the wrongful death savings provision, and therefore we submit supersedes the effect of the savings provision in the wrongful death statute. Secondly, if you assume that the legislature intended to treat wrongful death plaintiffs differently, then you can, what I'm saying is you can avoid the equal protection analysis altogether by looking at the legislative history of the amendments to the general purpose saving statute and to the wrongful death saving statute. It is clear that the intention was to close what has colloquially been called the malpractice trap. The intention was to close this trap within the generally applicable statute. The appellant has brought up that the wrongful death savings provision was amended subsequent to the change brought by HB 161. That change only redefined and updated who the wrongful death beneficiaries could be in the wrongful death statute and did not substantively address the existence of the trap. Taken all together, it looks like this is simply an oversight or a scrivener's error, and that there is no actual intention on the part of the General Assembly to have left the malpractice trap open in the wrongful death savings provision. And finally, regarding the immunity issue, as Mr. Stinn has just stated, the affirmative defense of political subdivision immunity was raised in this case not even by an answer, but by a Rule 12 motion. Mr. Stinn has accurately stated what the general rule of immunity, the exceptions applicable to the subdivision, different exceptions applicable to employees of the political subdivision, and then exceptions to the exceptions. This labyrinthine structure of the political subdivision statute speaks to the need for there to be discovery on what, how any of these different decisions might apply, and for the need for at least an answer that asserts the affirmative defense of immunity. I'm not aware, with the exception of the statute of limitations, I'm not aware of any affirmative defense that can be asserted not through an answer, but instead by a Rule 12 motion. Under Rule 12, obviously, the complaints that are asserted in the facts that are asserted in the complaint must be taken as true. While the political subdivision statute lays out a long and complicated series of rules that govern the circumstances under which political subdivisions and their employees could be liable, at the point of the complaint being filed and simply a motion being drawn, this is really not any point for where it makes any sense to assert political subdivision immunity by a Rule 12 motion rather than by pleading.
So, Mr. Traska, are you saying that a political subdivision could never win on the immunity issue if it brought it through a motion for judgment on the pleadings?
Your Honor, yes. I think that is the only sound rule that, that can apply here. In a notice pleading jurisdiction, and obviously this is a notice pleading jurisdiction, there are a few carefully limited exceptions to when we have notice pleading. Obviously, matters of fraud by, I believe it's Civil Rule 9. This court articulated a different exception for employer intentional tort, where Mitchell versus Lawson, I believe, is the holding. None of those circumstances have been applied to political subdivision immunity, and it would not make any sense to do so in light of the fact that, again, the general is immunity. There are five main exceptions applicable to the subdivision itself. There are different exceptions applicable, and then there are defenses to the exceptions. It's completely unwieldy to require a plaintiff to blueprint the entire case, and especially to require that in this case where that had never been the law before. Now, Mr. Stinn has said that there is nothing in the complaint that would state any facts that would show or go toward any exception to the immunity, and that's not true. If you would look at paragraph 3 of the complaint, it says that Joshua was left in the care and custody of the school board and that the school board negligently supervised him. Well, there you have it. Now, what the affirmative defense of immunity goes to what are the particulars of the school board's duty for that care, custody, and supervision. But obviously, this is where it's a matter that's appropriate for a Rule 56 motion. It is not a matter that's appropriate for a Rule 12 motion before the case has had any opportunity to develop and for parties to conduct discovery.
So you're really arguing about the vehicle that the appellant is using to raise this issue?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And that obviously is an issue that that the importance of which reaches far beyond this case. But for immunity to come in as a Rule 12 motion is would be against this court's O'Brien case, the U.S. Supreme Court's Conley versus Gibson test too. The point is that not only are there facts for a Rule 12 motion, the facts in the complaint have to be taken as true, but secondly, and Justice Pfeiffer, you were going toward this point before, under civil rule, I believe it's 8D, the assertion of an affirmative defense is considered automatically denied. So you see how at the pleading stage, the rules contemplate that there's a plain statement of the facts, there's an iteration of what the defenses are, and that sets the parameters for the parties to go forward. As opposed to, as Justice Lanziger has pointed out, as opposed to when the case is more developed, a summary judgment motion asserting all the same bases, that might be a different set of circumstances.
Are you suggesting that discovery is always needed to handle an immunity question in cases like this?
Well, as a practical matter, yes. That the political subdivision rules are, I think we all have to concede, very complicated. Honestly, I'm not sure that I'm taking the meaning of your question. I think to come back to what you asked before, that is it the case that immunity can never be raised successfully on a Rule 12 motion? Yes, categorically, that doesn't, you know, like I said, it's not impossible for any affirmative defense to come in by Rule 12 motion, and the most ready example I can think of is statute of limitations, because it doesn't require you to look outside the pleadings. You can tell that a statute of limitations is met or is not met by the face of the document itself. But
Mr. Traska, the evidence is not going to show anything other than the fact that this student who was killed in the car was riding in a car not owned by the school district, driven by another student, not an employee of the school district, and it did not occur on school grounds. Now, why isn't a 12B6 motion, in the interest of determining what claim should go filed by plaintiff should go forward, so that clients don't spend their money needlessly, and the system, judicial system, isn't using its resources to process claims that really have no merit based upon what the plaintiff has said. Here's my claim, and this is why I think the defendants are liable. I don't see how you get around it. It's very tight language. I mean, the General Assembly, we may not agree with this language that the General Assembly has given us, but here it is. You know, how do you get around it?
Well, two ways. Number one is the B4 subsection of 2744.02B4. Yeah. This is the premises defect language. Now, I understand that the accident occurred off school grounds, but we've also cited the administrative code provision to the effect that when your child is attending school, there is a responsibility for, it's actually the principal or the principal's designee of the school to monitor the loading area for the buses to make sure that the kids get on okay. It is very conceivable that there was a premises issue, a defect in the premises, that made it impossible difficult.
What premises?
The premises at the school.
A defect in the premises at the loading site, or?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, if there were...
How caused the accident to occur?
Well, not the cause of the accident, but the obviously the school district is not liable for Corey Jenkins driving, but they may be liable for failing to execute their duty to make sure that Josh Epley got on the bus instead of going home with his friend.
Your argument is that the employee's misconduct occurred,
right,
on the premises at this site at which was still owned by the still property of the school. But
That's
there's
correct.
No defect in that premises.
Well,
defective judgment, maybe, but not in the premises.
Discovery could show that a premises defect contributed to this bad oversight. If the layout of the school makes it impossible for whoever the principal or the designee is to actually see the kids get onto the bus, then what you have is somebody with a regulatory duty to act who might not be able to do it, and that may be an architectural thing. That may be because if we got testimony at a deposition saying, well, geez, that line of buses goes for miles and we can't see all the buses and there's a tree line in the way or whatever, it's very thinkable that the layout of the school may have made it impossible for the employee who has this duty to do the job.
I guess the problem we're still having is that the statute says the injury or death occurs caused by the negligence of their employees. You got that covered. And that occurs within or on the grounds of and due to physical defects. The death or loss has to occur on, the way I read the statute, has to occur on some school premises. Or we've got a case apparently that says school activity off premises, which
right.
Doesn't seem to quite fit the statute, but we have it, so.
It's the act of supervision, and perhaps my recollection of the statute is, I'm not 100% sure I'm convinced or I'm correct on this, but I believe it's the negligence, not just the injury or the death, that has to occur on school grounds.
Well, we can argue about that, but the way I read it, it's the injury or death has to occur. It's injury, death, or loss to person or property that is caused by the negligence of their employees. You've got that covered. And that occurs, referring back to, mm-hmm. You can maybe argue the negligence occurs, but I think and occurs refers back to death or injury.
Okay. But right, and that may be an untried issue.
We don't want to argue about it here.
It seems like the place to do just that, Your Honor. But, that's one exception among five in the B subsection of the statute. Go forward to the section that's applicable to employees individually. Now, I understand Mr. Stinn has preempted this and has said, well, you had John Doe's named in the first complaint. They were not identified specifically. They were not served. The complaint was refiled and dismissed. I understand what that motion will say, but that motion has not been made in this case, which comes back to how easy is it to walk away from your obligations as a defendant. You actually have to make the motion to get the benefit of the motion. John Doe's have not actually been, there has been no effort to seek dismissal of John Doe's in this action. So the Court of Appeals was correct in concluding that there is possibly, no offense to Mr. Stinn, I'm sure I'll see this motion if this court affirms, but there is the possibility that the action is alive as respects individual employees. Now, 2744.03a6 is a sword. The 1 through 5 of that section of the statute are defenses, but 06 is the vehicle by which there can be liability against individual employees of the school district. So again, we come back to the administrative code, saying that the principal or the principal's designee has the duty to make sure that kids get on the bus safely. If that duty has failed for reasons that tie into one of the available exceptions to immunity, then it's possible that there is some set of facts. And again, it's not, this isn't the review of a Rule 56 motion. There has not been an affirmative showing by the defense in this case that there is no set of facts or what the facts are. So on review of a Rule 12 motion, this court is bound, the Court of Appeals was correct to conclude that if there is any set of facts by which an exception to immunity may be proved, then we should go forward. And if the court has no further questions, I would urge affirmance of the Fifth District Court of Appeals decision.
Thank you, Mr. Traska.
Thank you.
Mr. Stinn, you've saved almost 3 minutes of your time.
Part of the issues in this case, it deal with the equal protection of the law. If you deny political subdivisions the right to file 12C motions, I think you would be denying them the equal protection of the law. You would be giving them, or you would denying them a right to do what every other litigant can do in the proper situation, that is to file a 12C motion. So I don't think that's the rule that this court wants to adopt. Part of the argument that Mr. Trasker made was that the Ohio Administrative Code applies to this case. Again, that wasn't in the complaint. That wasn't argued below. The first time that's been raised is here. But even if that had been argued below, it's the Ohio Administrative Code. It's not a section of the revised code. And both 2744.02b5 and 2744.03a6c, the one applies to the board, the other applies to the employees, both say that a political subdivision or the employee can be held liable if a specific section of the revised code provides specific liability, civil liability. The Ohio Administrative Code isn't a section of the revised code, and the administrative code that he cites doesn't provide specific civil liability. So that does not apply to this case.
Okay, counsel, the—
Yes, sir.
The problem the plaintiff here is their case hangs on a very thin reed. I don't think any of us are suggesting that we would ever adopt something that says you can't ever file a 12b6. What I suggested with my line of questions is the complexity of the statute. The norm in this would be that the cases go out on summary after there's the back and forth, the filing of the answer, and the exploring of this winding road through the what's in and what's out. I want to explore the possibilities under the statute again. Schools, it seems to me, are very careful about loading kids on buses and making sure that they go home on the proper bus, and if they're going home with somebody else, that they have a note from the parents and all of that kind of stuff. If there was a failure to perform that activity in a proper fashion, the exclusions would not apply because it happened on school grounds. Is that correct? For example, a child goes home with a kid where there's a known pedophile, child molester in the house, and something awful happens, and there wasn't a note from the parent. You could see how that slip-up could happen.
Well, I don't know in this case, because we decided this, or the court decided this, on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. I don't know if there was a note. I don't know if the parents contacted the school board and said, my kid can't go home with this kid or that kid or Corey Jenkins. But even assuming that that happened and the school board didn't follow those instructions, that would be negligence under your hypothetical. But it would not be a defect on the school premises.
So it would be immune?
It would be the exception 2744.02b4. Okay,
that's what I'm trying to explore.
Would not apply because the injury did not occur or the death did not occur because of a defect on the premises. And that's what the statute said on the date this occurred. Prior to the amendment of that statute, which I think occurred in April of 2003, you could have a negligent supervision claim or a negligent maintenance claim. And I think the Hubbard case, this court essentially said that you can't take the statute as amended and apply it to facts that occurred prior to the amendment of the statute. In the Hubbard case, there was a negligent supervision claim, and the defendant argued that the B4 exception didn't apply. And this court said no. Negligent supervision claims at that time existed and could be brought. But since the amendment to the statute,
which occurred
in April of 2003,
okay,
before the date of this kid's untimely demise, an unfortunate demise.
And it's that amendment that you believe.
And I believe that amendment
lets the school skate.
If using your term, under your hypothetical, I don't think the school did anything wrong, but yes, under your hypothetical, if they were negligent in supervising the drop-off or pick-up, coming home, going to school, then it was not a defect on the premises. They cannot be held liable under that section. It doesn't apply. But even if it does, then you go to the defenses. And admittedly, we haven't gotten there yet. So, Mr. Trasker mentioned 2305.19. Saying that it applies to every, it does apply to every non-wrongful death claim. Wrongful death claims are statutory claims. and they were not recognized under the common law. Because they're statutory claims, this court and the courts that I have cited in the briefs all say that the statutes have to be strictly applied and construed. And one of the statutes in the wrongful death claim statutes is that it has to be brought within 2 years. That's an essential element of the claim. This case wasn't. And the other statute is 212504.
You've used your time, Mr. Stinn.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.